Shemos begins with Shemos. Ve'ele Shemos b'nei Yisrael haba'im Mitzrayim. And there's a very interesting comment of the Medrash, Shemos Rabbah, on the reiteration of the names of B'nai Yisrael, all of those 12. It's a question that is dealt with by many Meforshim. Rashi himself asked the question. We know who the sons of Yisrael are. We've also had them mentioned in the Pasuk as coming down to Mitzrayim. So it purely seems to be a question of repetition, seemingly. Rashi has his explanation, as do others. And the Medrash, amazingly, explains that actually the names of the Shvatim pertain to the content of Chumash Shemos. Shemos is, as we will say, Sefer HaGeula, although it begins with Shibud, but it becomes the Sefer of Geula. And all of the names of the Shvatim are darshaned by the Medrash as referring to aspects of Geula. And therefore it is very much Me'inyan HaParsha to mention them here. And as Mefarshim explain, how is it that we were zochet to Geula? Basically, through the Jewish qualities became refined. Those qualities are embodied by the names of the Shvatim. The name of someone is their essence. The names of the Shvatim refer to the essential qualities of the Jewish people, and therefore it is most appropriate to expound their names with reference to the process of Geula. And it's fascinating to hear some of them, especially because when we talk about Geula, we will see how these names come out. Reuven. Well, the original Reuven is Ki Ra'ah Hashem Ba'onyi. Hashem saw my affliction. Well, Hashem saw our affliction. Reuven, Ra'o Ra'isi, Esoni Ami. Hashem says, I have seen. Reuven from the word to see. Shimon, to hear. Vayishma Elokim, Esna Kasam. And Yisachar. We're not going to go through all of them, but just some of the Yisachar, Shenasan Lehem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Sachar Shibudam. Yisachar from Sachar, payment. We were reimbursed. That's the Ruchush Gadol, is Yisachar. Then, Zevulun. What's Zevulun? How does he feature in here? Says the Medrash, Al Shem Shehishkin HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shchinoso Bikirbam, that Hashem caused His divine presence to dwell amongst Bnei Yisrael. And Zevulun refers to the Mishkan or Mikdash, as it says, Bano Banisi Beis Zevul Lecha Machon Hashivtecha Olamim. Dan Hashem V'gam Hagoy Asher Yavodu Dan Anochi. And finally for Tali, Al Shem HaTorah U'Mitzvos Shenasan HaKadosh Baruch Hu. How has Naphtali got to do with Torah and Mitzvos? Shekasav Behem U'Mesukim Midvash V'Nofes Tzufim. Nofes related to Naphtali. So we see the general idea, and that is that there are certain names of the Shvatim that refer to the Shibud. Hashem saw our affliction, heard our cries. There are certain that refer to the Geula. But it's interesting to note that actually some of them we say, Al-Shem Geulason, some of these names are seemingly post-Geula. As if to say, the Geula is we left Mitzrayim, but some of the names of the Shvatim are darshan for things that happened after that. Zevulun is the Mishkan. I mean, that's after we left Mitzrayim. Naphtali, Torah and Mitzvos, that's Matan Torah, that's after we left Mitzrayim. And therefore, how do they fit into this idea of Al-Shem Geulason Heim Nikra'im? Well, some Mefarshim say very simply that when it says that they are called after aspects of Geula, it doesn't mean to be confined to the Geula, but it means Geula and beyond. So if it's after Geula, noch besser. So it's okay. So Matan Torah is after Geula, and the Mishkan is after Geula. Okay, that's also all right. However, the Sefer Shiras David, Rav Aaron David Goldberg Shalita, explains that here the Medrash is corroborating an idea that we will see from the Ramban in his introduction to Chumash Shemos. And Ramban, as he has in his introductions, explains why it is that the Svarim contain the things they do, discuss the things they do, and are divided in that way. What defines Chumash Bamidbar? What defines Chumash Bereishis? And for our discussion this evening, what defines Chumash Shemos? Well, he refers to Chumash Shemos, as indeed Chazal themselves do, as the Chumash HaGeula. Okay. And that being the case, we need to understand why it begins where it begins and why it ends where it ends. Well, it begins with the Golus, because the Golus is really from which we were redeemed. But then, says Rambam, in his short introduction to Shemos, V'hine, HaGolus einenu nishlam. Golus is never really over. Ad yom shuvam el mikomam, until the time that we return to our original place, ve'el malas avosam yashuvu, and to return to the level that the avos, that our forebears, enjoyed. In other words, Ramban is mentioning two aspects of geula. The one we could say is physical, return back to our place, and the second is spiritual. And therefore, the question is, at what point are we considered redeemed? Ukashiyatsu mi Mitzrayim, having left Mitzrayim, which takes place in Parshas Bo and Beshalach, afa pishe yatsu mi beis avodim. Okay, we've left the house of slavery, of servitude. That's not called redeemed yet. That's stage one. Adayin yichashvu golim. We're still really in exile. Ki hayu be'eretz lo lahem, nevuchim bamidbar, in the middle of the desert. The desert is not a state of geula. It's not godless like Mitzrayim, but it's a process that's begun, has yet to be finished. Okay, and therefore Chumash Shemos continues. However, ukishebo el har Sinai, when we came to har Sinai, v'asu hamishkan, and then made the Mishkan, v'shav HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'hishra shchinaso b'neihem, and then the divine presence came to rest amongst us, Az shabu el malas avosam. Then we were able to return to the level, to some degree, to some significant degree, to the level of our forebears. Shayasod eloka alei ahaleihem, behemim hamirkava. And presence rest in the abodes of the avos and the imahos. So too it came to rest amongst the machane Yisrael. Va'az nechshavu geulim, and then we're called geulim. And that is why Chumash Shemos ends where it does. It ends after the building of the Mishkan. The building of the Mishkan isn't something that we did after we were redeemed. It's something that we did in order to be considered significantly redeemed. Because through the building of the Mishkan, receiving the Torah and the Mishkan, the Shekhinah came back. And that's called El Malas Avosam Yoshuvu. Now clearly, of course, we never made it by the end of Chumash Shemos back to Eretz Yisrael. We didn't make it fully by the end of the Chumash back to Eretz Yisrael. Quite so. And therefore, Chumash Shemos really could have gone into Sefer Yehoshua. But the point is that in terms of the two, shall we say, metrics of Geula, namely El Mekomam, which would not happen until after the Chumash, right, until Sefer Yehoshua, but then with the aspect of El Malas Avosam Yeshuvum, that we were yet able to attain, and it was done so through Matan Torah and building the Mishkan. And therefore, at that point, Chumash HaGeula ends when we receive the Torah, because to the extent that we can in the Chumash, we have achieved full redemption. Says Shiras David, that should give us new insight into this Medrash, which tells us that the Shvatim, are their names relate to aspects of Geula. And some of them relate to the Geula from Mitzrayim, but then again we had Naphtali who relates to Matan Torah, Nofes Tzufim, we had Zevulun who relates to the Mishkan, Bano Banisi Beis Zevul Lach, and how is that Geula? Says Shiras David, that's not post-Geula, that's Geula, because those are the final stages as the Ramban outlines them of the process of Geula, receiving the Torah and building the Mishkan to have the Shekhinah amongst us. So that really is a wonderful corroboration, as we say, of the Ramban's introduction from the Medrash itself. Geula is a process. It doesn't just happen on one day. It begins at a certain point, and it takes a while until the pieces are assembled. And as we said, the full Geula would happen really after the Chumash, when we return not only El Malas Avosam, but also El Mekoma. It's very interesting, apropos of this discussion, Geula and post-Geula, to see what the Medrash's drasha on the word Yosef. I mean, how's Yosef got to do with his name? How does it relate to Geula? Says the Medrash, Yosef Sheyosif legaaleinu. Hashem should continue to redeem us. Hashem should redeem us even more. Because we're in Galus again. Yosif legaaleinu. So this seems to be the one example where it's obviously by definition post-Ge'ula because we're back in Galus again. But the truth of the matter is, it's possible to say that even Yosef legaaleinu, Hashem should redeem us in the future, is still marking the Ge'ula from Mitzrayim. And the reason is, as we've mentioned on a number of occasions, the relationship of Galus Mitzrayim and Ge'ulas Mitzrayim to subsequent Golios and Ge'ulos is that really of root to branch, in the sense that the seminal root Golos experience of for us was in Mitzrayim, and therefore, as we say, and the Medrash tells us in Bereishis Rabbah, when it comes to the Bris Ben Abesarim, when Avram, the Pasuk describes, V'hine Eima, Hashecha, Gedola, Nofelasalah, this great, terrible dread and darkness, and the Medrash says that those four expressions allude to the four Golios and goes to explain each one. And the point is, as Avram is anticipating and seeing the coming Golos of Mitzrayim, he really is also seeing all of the Golios, because it encapsulates all of them as root to branch. And moreover, the Medrash likewise tells us that when Hashem says, "Vegames hagoya sheyavodu don anochi," also, we know the word gam is always taken as a riboy. It comes to include. What does it come to include? Says the Medrash, "Lerabos arba golios." Not just Mitzrayim and on a root level, but also, as history unfolds, the subsequent golios. And therefore, if the golos of Mitzrayim is the root of all golios, then the geula from Mitzrayim is the root of all geulos. And thus, as we say, Yosef, Yosif lega'aleinu, that's still marking the Geula from Mitzrayim, because it's the Geula from Mitzrayim that gives us the potential and the wherewithal already for Geula first from subsequent Golios. But this does give us a deeper insight, really, into all of the elements of Sefer Shemos and Parsha Shemos specifically, because as it describes the Golos, it's describing many things one could almost say as Maase Avos for subsequent Golios, as we've seen on many occasions. We mentioned in the past the statement of the Chidah, whereas the Pasuk begins, Ve'ele Shemos B'nei Yisrael Haba'im Mitzrayim. They're coming to Mitzrayim, not Asher Ba'u Mitzrayim in the past, but they're coming to Mitzrayim. It's an ongoing thing. It's not true only Mitzrayim, but even beyond that. And as the Chidah points out, the word Haboim, they're coming, Boim, base, Aleph, Yud, Mem, is actually Rosh Hatevos of Bovel, Edom, Yavon, and Modai. Haboim Mitzrayim, as they're coming to Mitzrayim, they're coming into all of those Golios on that root level. And when they're redeemed from Mitzrayim, they have the wherewithal for redemption from subsequent Golios. So these are some discussions that emerge from what seems to be the repetition of the names. Shemos B'nai Yisrael in Parsha Shemos is very different than Shemos of B'nai Yisrael in any other setting, as the Medrash tells us. Now, I'd like to refer to a comment of Rashi, very interesting comment with regards to the Mialdos, those two midwives, Shifra and Pua, who defied Paro. And he wanted them to kill the males as soon as they were born, as they were being born. As the Vilna Gaon says, this was early days for Paro. And he yet had some type of feeling that he shouldn't be so obviously targeting the Jewish people. And therefore, he wanted to kill the males by making it look like the tragedy happened at birth. So that's to the midwives. But even before they're born, and they could inform the mothers of the unfortunate news. He couldn't bring himself yet at that stage to precipitate a program of out-and-out killing. It wouldn't take long. In a few seconds' time, he's there already. But in the early stages, he wanted really the midwives to do his work for him and make it look like it was an accident. And even though he was hoping for thousands and thousands of accidents, that's just statistics. He can live with that. And yet they defy him. And Pasuk Kafbeis of Perik Aleph tells us their sachar. Pardon me, Pasuk Kaf Aleph. Vayhi, as the Pasuk says in the end of Rishon, They feared God, velo asu kasher diber lehen melech Mitzrayim, and they did not do what Melech Mitzrayim told them, which is, the more one thinks about it, it's really unbelievable to defy Paro in that way. And therefore, Pasuk Kaf Aleph tells us, "Vayhi ki yaru hamiyaldes eso lehem," as they feared God, "Vayas lehem batim." Hashem made houses for them. There is actually some discussion as to what these houses are and who made the houses amongst Meforshim. Before we get to Rashi, some say that actually "Vayas lehem batim" is not referring to Hashem but referring to Paro. Paro made houses. And why did he make houses? He made houses because they kept on saying, you know, by the time that we're called for the birth, they've already given birth. So Paro made arrangements for them to be on location. So they wouldn't have that excuse. Vayas lehem batim. So Rishonu explained that way. Others say it's Hashem made batim for them, just to the question really of the pronoun, Vayas, he made for them. Who's he? The last person referred to most recently is Paro. But then Hashem has been referred to in the pasuk, "Vater kiyaru hamialdos es ha'elokim," and therefore, who is he now who's making batim for them? Rashi prefers that it's to explain that it's Hashem who makes batim for them, which is actually corroborated by the beginning of the next pasuk, Kaf Beis, "Vayitzav paro l'chol amo le'mor." Sounds like until now we've been referring to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So their sachar, or the response for them defying paro, is "Vayas lahem batim." And what does batim mean? Says Rashi, you know what batim means? Bate kahuna ulevia umalchus. Houses, but not houses in terms of structures, concrete houses, or houses in terms of households, like the house of Beis Aaron, Beis Yehuda, the house of David, that type of house. They're also called batim. Okay? And what's this got to do with Shifra and Pua? Well, Rashi has told us from the Gemara in Sotah, Shifra and Pua are none other than Yocheved and Miriam. Of course, Kahuna and Leviah come from Yocheved, that's Moshe and Aaron. And Malchus also comes from them because Miriam was married to Kalev, and Kalev is the progenitor of Malchus. He's someone in the link there from Yehuda down to Malchus based up it. So those are the houses. The houses are houses of Leviah and Kahuna. And the question some Meforshim ask is, even if it's Hashem who's making houses for them, why does Rashi prefer to explain that the houses in question are not structures, but rather households? So maybe it means houses, or whatever that means. A house sounds like a house. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe says a wonderful thing. The Pasuk says, in giving us, to explaining what Hashem, describing what Hashem did, "Vayihi ki yaru hamialdus es ha'elokim, vayya'as lahem batim." He made houses for them. Says the Lubavitcher Rebbe, you look through all of Chumash, you will never find the verb asiya when it comes to making a house. We say you made a house, but the Chumash always refers to building a house. Vayiven, right? Mia isha shebona bayis, kitivne bayis chadash. Houses are built, they're not made. Well, so if that's the case, then if there's a house, and the pasuk doesn't say vayiven lehem batim, but rather vayas lehem batim, it sounds like it's the type of house that you don't build, but that you make, and that's a household. That's bate kahuna, bate leviya, bate yehuda. That's a wonderful diktuk there from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And the truth is, it actually resonates with a comment made in the Sefer Ravid HaZahav. The Sefer Ravid HaZahav was written by Rav Dov Ber Treibish, who was actually the Rav in Vilna at the time of the Vilna Gaon. And one often wonders exactly what that felt like, but because the Vilna Gaon was not a Rav of a community or of a shul. And so the Rav of Vilna in his time was the Rav Treibish, the Ravid HaZahav, and it's a very wonderful Sefer. And what he does is to show how very often things that we know to be halachically true are actually borne out by a careful reading of the psukim, if you know how to do it. We know that, for example, a sukkah is specifically diras arai. It has to be something which is temporary in nature. Okay, and there's ways that it's derived. The halacha says, the Ravid HaZahav, it's explicit in the pasuk, if you know how to read it. How so? Because in Parshas Vayishlach, which is actually the first reference of sukkah of some kind, which is when Yaakov, the Yaakov Nosa Sukosa. So the Pasuk says, Vayivan Lebayis, he built a house for himself, Olamiknehu Osa Sukos, and he made sukkos for his livestock. And that's why he called the name of the place sukkos. So the Ravid Hazav said, when it refers to the houses, it says Vayivan Lebayis. When it refers to the sukkos, it says Osa Sukos. How come it didn't say Vayivan Sukos? Apparently a sukkah isn't something that's built to any significant degree. You make one, but it's a diras arai. A house is built to last. A sukkah is made diras arai. It's a wonderful comment there of the Ravid Hazav, and it really corroborates again what the Rebbe says, that Vayas Lehem Batim refers to households, Bate le Kahuna, Levia, and Malchus. Okay. And still, we proceed to ask, what are we to make of this reward for Shifra and Pua? They defied Paro, and that's great Mesiras Nefesh, and their reward is houses of Kahuna, Levia, and Malchus. What's the Midah Keneged Midah, so to speak? So, Reb Velvel Soloveitchik, the Rav of Brisk, explains that the Midah Keneged Midah here is because Paro is specifically telling them to kill the males. But the females, of course, were to be kept alive. And that remains true even later on. The males are to be killed, the females are not. So now the question is the survival of the Jewish people at stake, if we may ask such a fundamental question? And the answer, fundamentally, is no, because Jewish identity goes after the mother. Which means as long as all the Jewish women are alive, notwithstanding the terrible tragedy that the men are killed out, but the Jewish people would continue through the mothers. There's only one thing that would not continue, and that is things that depend on the status of the father. But what are such things? Kedushas Yisrael comes from the mother, but the status of Shevet comes from the father. That means if a father from one tribe marries a mother from another tribe, the son goes off to the father. And therefore, really what they were saving as they risked their lives to save these male children is they were saving the Kedusha of the Shvatim. And that's why things that go after the father, that's why their reward was that the best of the Shvatim came from them. Kahuna, Leviah, Malchus. These are all things that would not have, as we know it, existed anymore, because there would be no Levi, there would be no Leviim, and there would be no Yehuda. That's how the Brisker Rav explains that in response to their Mesiras Nefesh for saving the males, they received those things that are male determined, Kahuna, Leviah, and Malchus. And it occurred to me that actually just this morning, perhaps we may understand another diktuk in the pasuk based on this. The pasuk states, "Vayihu ki yaru hamyaldos esho elokim." This is Kaf Aleph, reading again for the third time. "Vayas lahem batim," and Hashem made houses for them. Okay, what do we need to address in the pasuk? Well, what does houses mean? Is there anything else we need to address in the pasuk? Yes, the word lahem is masculine, but Shifra and Pua are women. So the pasuk should have said, "Vayikiru hamyaldos es elokim vayas lahen batim." As surely as earlier on, it doesn't need to be demonstrated, but we see it very clearly in pasuk Yud Ches, "Vayikra melech Mitzrayim lamyaldos vayomer lahen," with a nun, "Madu asisem," etc. So then that's correct, right? If they're feminine, so then it should be with a nun at the end. Why the men? Except, we've come to understand that sometimes a word can be a composite entity, a word in Lashon HaKodesh, as if to say it could have the body of the word, but it can have elements of other in order to give you a composite message. What's called the concept is to be found in the Maharal, Mekvaras Hashem, as well as in the Hamakdavar. And the truth is, the more you look around, the more you see it. There is actually an example in our parsha very similar to this idea from the Ksava Kabbalah. When Moshe runs away from Paro and he comes to the well, and then Yisro's daughters are there. and they fill up their vessels with water, and then they get shooed away. Vayavo haroim vayigarshum. Gerush, right? They're sent away. Okay, until Moshe helps them. So the Ksava Kabbalah asks a very similar, familiar sounding question. They're all girls, Sheva Bonos, which means the suffix of the pronoun should be feminine. It should have said, Vayavo haroim vayigarshun, and sent them away, right? Giresh ugirshu otan, not otan. So why does it have a masculine ending if you're talking about seven girls? However, since the Ksava Kabbalah, we know the background. Why were they being harassed? Why were they being given such a hard time? It's because of Yisro, right? Yisro was he was the chief high priest of Avodah Zarah, and he threw the whole thing in, and he became, that's one way to make yourself very unpopular in an idol-worshipping town, is to be the one in charge of everything and just to throw the whole thing in. And therefore they put him in Cherem, or the Midianite equivalent, and it's because of that, his family was harassed. And therefore says the Ksava Kabbalah, in order, this is communicated by the Torah, because in order to indicate that although they were suffering, it was on his account. So even though they're feminine, the pasuk has a masculine element to it. Vayigarshum, because it's really about their father. It's not about them. Very interesting. And if we may take that idea and apply it here, as surely as Shifra and Pua, both women, but the batim, since the whole point of these batim are things that are determined by the identity of the father, that is why it says Vayas Lahem batim and not Lahen batim, because they were given that type of bias where the identity of the father determines. So these are some comments with regards to the Sachar Vayas Lahem batim, and as we see from all different places, the corroborative ideas come out. Now, I'd like to move towards the Mare Hasne, which is in Perek Gimel. Of course, there's so much to say in Parsha Shemos. Some Parshas we really would have voted for more than 1 week, but no one asked us. So Perek Gimel, Pasuk Tet Zayin. We'll see some very leading words. Chamishi. Hashem says to Moshe, Lech v'asavta es ziknei Yisrael. Go, gather the elders of Israel, v'amata lehem Hashem elokei avoseichem ne'or elai, elokei Avraham, Yitzhak v'Yaakov, le'mor, pakod pokadati eschem, ve'esasui lachem b'mitzrayim. I have indeed taken account of you, and that which has been done to you in Mitzrayim. And of course, we look at the words pakod pokadati, and they are very significant words. They're motif words. These are the words with which Yosef, and according to the Masorah, even Yaakov, transmitted that the Geula will come through the words of Pakod Yifkod. That's how Vayichi ends. And there's a lot to talk about this phrase, and many Mefarshim address the fact that it's doubled over in that way. Pakod Pakadati. And that's always a very delicate situation, because the English translation finesses it away. Whenever these words are doubled over, it means it's translated as indeed or surely or all those things. But everything that happens in the Torah is sure and indeed. So not for that is the repetition. Rav David Hevel, one of the Talmidim, the primary Talmidim of Rav Chaim Volozhin, the two Talmidim of Hakim, in his Drashel, actually, the nature of Pakod Pakadati is rooted in its grammatical form. Because this form, what's called Pakod, it's known as an absolute. It's an absolute infinitive. It's not restricted in any way. Pakod Pakadati, it's an absolute infinitive. And the point is that Pakod Pakadati means I've taken account of you to redeem you completely. That's the point. You have been taken account of completely because you'll be redeemed completely. When these words are uttered, it means this is the final geula from Mitzrayim. And if we may perhaps paraphrase, if taking account redeems, then absolutely taking account redeems absolutely. And therefore, Pakod Pakadati means you will be finished with Mitzrayim. The question is, however, we know that when they come to Paro, they actually ask for 3 days. So it doesn't really sound like they're asking to be sent down for good. Whatever happened to Pakod Pakadati? And really, that's a general question. If the plan was to leave for good, why did they ask for 3 days? And the Or HaChaim HaKadosh explains that this is also part of the Mida Keneged Mida for Mitzrayim. In other words, not only were Mitzrayim punished for enslaving them, but they were punished in the way that they enslaved them. The Jewish people were enslaved through deception. Originally, it was equal pay, equal work, we're all in it together. And of course, the Jews turned up because if everyone's equal, then the Jews would certainly have to be equal. And they're good citizens. They turned up. And slowly but surely, everyone else kind of faded away. And the pay got less and less. But it happens incrementally. And one can never really say, oh, today it's become unacceptable. It just got worse and worse. But on such a gradual basis, until before they looked around, they were trapped. That's why the Zohar HaKadosh says that when the pasuk says "Vayimaru es hayehem bechomer uvelvenim," the Zohar says "bechomer" means kal vachomer, and then the Zohar says not only kal vachomer but also gezeira shava, and it sounds like we're back in Psukei Dezimra because kal vachomer and gezeira shava, and what's this got to do with working for Mitzrayim? But Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, in his introduction to his Perush on the Haggadah, explains that kal vachomer and gezeira shava are the Zohar's way of referring to the deception in Mitzrayim. It began kal and became chomer, became easy, started easy, and then got progressively harder from kal to chomer. But they could never really put their finger on, you know, the day we've got to get out now. And the other thing, gezeira shava, it was a decree that was equal for all people, Jews, non-Jews, Egyptians, everyone, even Paro. But then in the end, some people, I guess, ended up more shava than others. And therefore, part of the anguish really of Mitzrayim, of the Golus Mitzrayim, is the knowledge that they've kind of been duped into it. And therefore, as the Mitzrayim are punished, not only are they punished by being forced to leave, but they're also being punished by being deceived. That moment when they really thought they were coming back, it's 3 days, and then another 3 days, they're not coming back, and they realize that they had been deceived into letting Bnei Yisrael go, that's the full Midah Keneged Midah, because that's how they got them to enslave them in the first place. So says the Or HaChaim. But this does explain to us, and Rav David Tevel continues to discuss this, how the phenomenon that at certain key points, in certainly near the beginning, but also, you know, further on, the Jewish people, at signs of trouble, they want to go back to Egypt. We should go back. What are we doing here? Why'd you take us out? And it sounds like they never really understood that they've been taken out of Mitzrayim. I mean, if they've read the Parsha of Shemos, Ba'ir, Bo B'Shalach, they should know. This is Yetzias Mitzrayim. So why are they saying, why you take us out? Why did you agree to come out? But it's quite possible that the Jewish people themselves, or Bnei Yisrael at that time, as much, they actually thought that they were only coming out for a little while. Not completely. And the background to that, by the way, is that if they know anything, they know that they're meant to be in Mitzrayim for 400 years. And working for 400 years. They don't like it, but they know it. And on the contrary, no one can really work out how they came out as early as they did. But they did, so they have to work it out. But to put ourselves in the mindset of the Jewish people, as far as they're concerned, they're not even dreaming of Geula for themselves. They're holding out for Geula for their great-great-great-grandchildren in 190 years' time. But now, it's not. But they're prepared to leave, because they're prepared to leave for a little while. I mean, that's 3 days. And that's why, interestingly, as much as Moshe comes and relays the message of Pakod Pakadati, which, as we said, means absolutely redeemed, the Pasuk tells us that the people believed Moshe. But the way the Pasuk describes it in the end of Perek Dalet says, Vaya'amein ha'am, Perek Dalet Pasuk Lamed Aleph, they believed. What did they believe? Vayishmu'u ki pakad Hashem es b'nei Yisrael. Pakad. One pakad, not two. Meaning they were believed that they had been taken account of and that they were being released, but they did not believe that they were being released absolutely. That was something that they still needed to come on board with. And that's why we find, amazingly, that they began to think, in a moments of crisis, that maybe it was really Moshe's idea to keep them out. But maybe God's idea was they should go back. And that's why they were stuck. And that's why when they see in the beginning of B'Shalach, when they see that Pyro is coming after them, B'nai Mitzrayim Nosei Achareihem, they have two reactions. Reaction number one, Vayitzaku B'nai Yisrael Hashem. They cry out to Hashem. Reaction number two, they complain to Moshe. Why'd you take us out? So we need to understand, do they want to take the religious approach and daven and be good Jews, or do they want to take the contentious approach? But says Reb David Tevel, it could be they didn't see a contradiction between these two. They're davening to Hashem, Hashem will always help them. And then they complain to Moshe because they thought he's the one that's keeping them out. If you would have followed the real plan, which as we understand it, and the Jewish people always know best, so we would be back in Mitzrayim by now. They were practically davening to Hashem to save them as much from Moshe and his ideas as they were from Paro and his people. They didn't realize that they'd been, so difficult was it for them to absorb the idea that they'd been absolutely, and they're really free. And a lot of really the Chumash is the Jewish people in that generation, in a sense, catching up with their freedom. And that's why it's very interesting to note that the Pasuk talks about Moshe taking Yosef's bones, right? Vayikach Moshe's atmos Yosef imo. It mentions it in the beginning of Parshas Beshalach. Not many Mefarshim raise this question, but that's seemingly not the appropriate place to talk about it, because they've already left. Moshe's bones can't be with them in the beginning of Beshalach unless they were there halfway through. Sorry, Yosef's bones, until they were halfway through Parshas Bo. They can't be with them there if they weren't there from the outset. So why is it not in Parshas Bo? As they're leaving, Vayikach Moshe, as Atzmos Yosef Imo. How come that's not mentioned in Bo? Then Bishalach, and they're already on their way, and the Torah almost goes back to that. You know, Vayikach, it's like a non sequitur. Except the point is, the Torah there is highlighting the fact that Moshe took Atzmos Yosef Imo. No one else from the people at large really got involved, because Yosef says, you know when you should take me out? It's mentioned again there. No one else really thought that it's appropriate to take Yosef out, because it's pakod, but it's not pakod yivkod. And therefore, the only one who did was Moshe. And that almost sets the scene, or sets the tone for what's about to happen, Parshas Beshalach, as everyone starts complaining. So that's a very interesting way of looking at really all of these events, pakod pakadati versus pakod, and really a lot of Yetzias Mitzrayim is about gradually closing the gap in the consciousness of the Jewish people that it's been more than pakad, it's been pakod pakadati. We should mention that there is another approach, also quite mechudash, and that's from Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, maybe others say it before him. And Rabbi Yaakov says that actually the request to leave Mitzrayim for 3 days, it could be that it was a genuine request. As if to say, the ideal, quote-unquote, way to experience the Bris Ben HaBesharim, it really is to have those 400 years in Mitzrayim. They, in their own way, they are a refining and purifying experience for Bnei Yisrael. It's called the Kor Azot. And therefore, except the Jewish people, they couldn't take it. Except, what's the antidote to that? Perhaps if they just have some time, maybe they can recharge and go back. And Rabbi Yaakov understands that that was actually the original plan. They should see out, if they can, the 400 years in Mitzrayim. They're almost breaking point now, so give them a bit of time out. The Nizbuch al Hashem Elokeinu, just take just a few days and take them back. Ironically, it was Paro's response, right? His diabolical response to that request of even 3 days, and the way that he reacted, that precipitated things and actually ended up in them being released for good. But the notion that there's an idea almost like a break in the middle of a golus in order to recharge and finish it, that's something that would come back. So we've mentioned that in our discussion on Hanukkah, according to some Rishonim and Achronim, Rabbeinu Chisda, Ibn Kreskas, and Rabbi Yonasan Ivershutz, the Tkufa of the Second Beis HaMikdash was such a period. It was essentially to be able to weather. They'd almost disintegrated in 70 years in Babel. It was to get them back, but only, all things being equal, to allow them to be sent back into Golas. It could have become the Geula, but that wasn't the trajectory coming back. And such an idea was the 3 day break. However, Pyrrha refused, and he made things worse, and therefore he was the one that really made it no longer appropriate or possible for the Jewish people to remain there at all, and thus they were released. It's very interesting, says Rabbi Yaakov, all of this is foretold, looking back, you can see it foretold in Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yudches, Yudtes and Kaf. And if we see the Psukim, it states Pasuk Yudches, go to tell the elders of Israel, Vishamu Lukalecha, and you should come to Paro and say, Va'amatem Elav, Hashem Elokei Evrim Nekor Aleinu, Va'atar, here's our request, Nel Chana Derech Shloshis Yomim Bamidbar. We would like to go for 3 days. Now says Hashem, Pasuk Yutes, Vani Yodati, Ki Lo Yitein Eschem Melech Mitzrayim Lahaloch. He won't let you go. Then it says, and therefore things will happen, Pasuk Kaf, Va'achareichein Yishalach Eschem. So it's interesting if we consider, monitor the way that the Jewish people, yes going, not going, the verbs have changed. Originally ask, Nel Chana, and he won't let you go. And in the end, he'll send you out. In other words, what will originally be an issue of Nel Chana just for those 3 days, in the end it won't be about that anymore. It will be an absolute Acharechein Yishalach Eschem completely. So that's the approach of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and as we see each one in their own way, very basic questions in the Parsha being dealt with. What does the Jewish people understand from that? What's with the 3 days? What does Pyrrha think? What does the Jewish people think? Etc. Now, I'd like to conclude by taking a look at the beginning of Perek Dalet, the signs. Moshe says, "V'hein le'yaminu li," they won't believe me, and therefore he gets some signs. And specifically, the first two, let's say, "V'yomer elav Hashem, mazeh biyadecha, v'yomer mateh," it's the staff, it turns into a snake, then it turns into a staff again. And that's the first sign. The second sign is that its hand becomes leprous and then it becomes healed again. And Pasuk Ches states, if they don't listen to the first sign, they'll listen to the second, to the last. Interestingly, parenthetically, these psukim are mentioned by the Tosfos Yom Tov in his Perush to Maseches Demai with reference to those who stated or maintained that they have evidence from the Tanakh that there's only two Bate Migdash, right? There's not going to be a third one. That was there. Everyone always likes to prove everything from Tanakh. And the more epic courses it is, the more psukim they feel they have. Because the Pasuk says, Godu Yekvod Habayis HaAcharon Min HaRishon, that's a Pasuk in Haggai. And it's talking about the second Beit HaMikdash, and it calls it Acharon. So you see, it's the second and last. If it's last, there's nothing after it. Says the Tosfos Yom Tov. Unfortunately, they never learned Chumash, because if they did, they would know that anything that at that moment is the last one is already called the Acharon, even though it will be followed. Because look at what Hashem says to Moshe. He says, if they don't listen to the first sign, they'll listen to the Kol HaAcharon, and then proceeds to give another one. Number three, but until number three comes along, number two is the Acharon, says the Tosfos Yom Tov. The same is true for the Beis HaMikdash. But now the question is, why is it that if they don't believe, why is Hashem saying they don't believe the first one, they'll believe the second one? Well, what does the second one have that the first one doesn't have? They're both miracles. So, what's that about? Actually, Rabbeinu Avraham ben Arambam, who we have his perush on the Torah of Brachos and Shemos, he actually says, and this is pshat, he says that actually there is nothing more compelling about the second than the first. They're actually both miracles. Except the point is, as is very often the case, something the first time doesn't make an impression, but the second one does, not because the second one is greater than the first, but it has a cumulative effect. As if to say, it's not the second one as opposed to the first, but both together. They'll be won over. Everyone, you know, can explain away one miracle, but if these two things happen, it's together. He says it's like Edim. One person comes and testifies. We're not sure. Another person, all of a sudden, it's true. It's corroborative. It's cumulative. So that's how Rabbeinu Avraham ben Rambam, as pshat as could be. It's not the second per se, it's just now there's two. Two is always better than one. Interestingly, Rashi does provide something about the second os over the first. Pasuk says, Pasuk says, "Deminu lekola osarachon." They'll believe the second. Why? Mishetomar lahem bishvilchem lakisi. You see, if you explain to them, not only do the miracle, but explain it, give it a bit of a peirush, and say, you know why my hand is leprous? Al shesiparti aleichem loshen hara. I spoke loshen hara about you, because I said, you know, vehein lo yaminu li, I said you wouldn't believe me. So that, you know, that was loshen hara, that's what Rashi's saying. So I got saras. If you tell them that, oh, they'll believe you. They'll believe you. Why? Shekvar lomdu bekach. Because they have experience in this. Shem izdavgim leharalahem. That anyone who tries to detract from them or do anything wrong to them, lokim binagoyim, will get saras. Plagues. Paro, Babi Melech, Bishosara. Paro, he started up with them. He got saras. Babi Melech also. So that they'll definitely believe you. I mean, the Rashi is just to pause for a moment before we move on to the methodological aspects. I mean, the Rashi is unbelievable. Because the Jewish people, what have they experienced for the last few decades is people making their lives a misery and nothing seems to be happening to them. So it's amazing that they'll actually be convinced by Moshe saying, you know, I spoke Lashon Hara about you and I got punished. And the Jewish people will say, yeah, that's right, you got punished. Of course, no one starts up with us. Well, the Egyptians are starting up with you. They haven't finished. It's amazing that they were able to preserve, you know, inside all of their subjugation, that sense of whoever starts up with us will get their comeuppance in the end. And sooner or later, you got it sooner, 100%. You must be telling the truth. That's all. That always happens with us. Wow. Why does Rashi say this? Says Mizrahi, as if to say, why does Rashi give this explanation? And by the way, there's a chiddush in Rashi, because it sounds like it's not the miracle per se that will win them over, but it's the commentary that you give it. If you just show them a leprous hand is like a staff turning into a snake. If they're not impressed by one, they're not impressed by the other. But explain to them the background, and then you'll win them over. Amazing. So it's miracle plus peirush, really. And maybe one could say that's called the kol ha'osa acharon, the voice that accompanies the osa acharon. But why does Rashi tell us how the second is better than the first? Because Rashi clearly does not understand like Rabbeinu Avraham ben Rambam. In other words, when it says, if they don't believe the first, they believe the second, it's the second specifically by itself, not cumulative, not both together. The second means the second as opposed to the first, not in addition to the first. But the question is, well, what is the second half that the first one doesn't have? So Rashi steps in to explain this idea that I spoke Lashon Hara, etc. and so forth. There's just one problem. And that is, when you come to the third miracle, which is about the blood, water being spilled out, turns into blood. So then, yeah, that's in Pasuk Tes. Vayam lo yaminu gam l'shnei osos. If they don't believe these two, so what you should do is take water from the Nile, they'll turn into blood. That's the third, and that will, there's no arguing with that. I mean, that'll absolutely seal it. And Rashi doesn't explain how that's so. So as if to say, the Mizrahi is saying, if you, Rashi, take the approach that really the point is that if they don't believe the first, they'll believe the second by itself, there's got to be a reason. And Rashi provides the reason. You'll say, I spoke Lashon Hara, and that will be it. But then if that's your approach, then if they don't believe that for some reason, they'll believe the third. But Rashi never said why they believe the third. And it can't be just, quote-unquote, a miracle, because the first two are miracles also. So Rashi left us hanging a little bit. What's the compelling reason that the third one would clinch it by itself? Because that's how he's apparently approaching these psukim. So the explanation of this Rashi, which is very profound, is in the Perush Be'er Yitzchak. The Perush Be'er Yitzchak on Rashi was written by someone called Rabbi Yitzchak Hurwitz, who lived, I believe, in the 1800s in Galicia. And it is a very rigorous Perush on Rashi. It's absolute. I mean, he has so many important things to say about Rashi's approach to things. And indeed, there were many where they would learn Kaseder, Rashi with Ber Yitzchak. He was their guide in Rashi. It was actually a professor I heard from, Rav Kupperman. That's our professor, Yerachmiel Bergman, I believe was his name. And he grew up there in Cheder. And in the Cheder, they would learn Rashi with Be'er Yitzchak. He later went on to teach a course in Rashi in the university, I think it's the Bar-Ilan University. And his course was based almost exclusively on his Cheder learning of Rashi with Be'er Yitzchak, because you can't do better. And it was taught at the highest level, from what he remember. He remembered the whole thing by heart. And the fact that Be'er Yitzchak is in print, thanks to Rav Kupperman, because Mr. Feldheim met him, as he recounted once, and says, "You know, I have funds to reprint a sefer that you think is exceptionally worthwhile. Do you have anything in mind?" And Rav Kupperman says, "Yes, Be'er Yitzchak," and he put him in touch with Professor Bergman and with Nechama Leibovitz, Aleiha Shalom, Al Pi Shnayim Edim Yochum Davar, and they both corroborated, and the Be'er Yitzchak came back in print. In any case, really, we need to understand Rashi's comments that if they don't believe the first one, they'll believe the second, but the reason why they'll believe it is because you'll tell them the explanation, I spoke Lashon Hara, etc. That's not Pshat. That's Drash. And why is it Drash? You see, the truth is the Pshat here is like Rabbeinu Avraham ben Aramba. The Pshat here is that it's cumulative. When it says if they don't believe the first, they'll believe the second, it means the two of them together. And when they don't believe the second, they believe the third, it means the three of them together. I mean, there's no question that that's the pshat. However, we need once again to remind ourselves of the difference between pshat and drash. What is the goal of pshat and what's the goal of drash? The goal of pshat and the method of pshat is to look at the pasuk in a straightforward way and to try and glean the straightforward meaning. Pshat is pashut, and that's it. You're not looking for trouble. And that's pshat. Drash, on the other hand, is, as we often say, is doresh. It seeks out. In other words, it's more demanding. Okay, I know the pshat. I know the straightforward. But still, I wish to have an accounting why the pasuk is written in the way that it does. Because the pshat sometimes, in a sense, glosses over that. If you're looking for a straightforward reading, you will avoid certain smaller issues. But the drash says, I'm not interested in avoiding any issues. I want everything to be accounted for. And therefore, it's very interesting to note that sometimes we perhaps will define superficially the difference between pshat and drash. We say that pshat is just the words. So what do the words mean? And that's that. Drash can sometimes, you know, add a bit more. Right? The drash takes out from the pasuk, the pshat takes out from the pasuk, and the drash puts into the pasuk. That's not accurate. Not only is it not accurate, sometimes the opposite is true. Because sometimes actually the pshat needs to add in words to the pasuk in order to make a straightforward reading. And the drash says, no, I don't want to add in words to the pasuk. I'd like to know why the pasuk is written exactly the way that it is with no added words. And an example of that is our pasuk. Our pasuk says, if they don't believe the first one, they will believe the second one. And that's all that it says. And it really sounds, if you translate literally, it sounds like they will believe the second one even without believing the first. There's something about the second one that exists that you don't have in the first. Now the pshat actually adds in words at this point and says they'll believe the second one together with the first. So ironically, it's the pshat that's adding in words. And that's okay for pshat. It means the second, and say, there's a subject. The second meaning both together. Possibly didn't say both together, but you can say it, and it's pshat. But then the drash says, well, yes, but I'd like to know why the pasuk didn't say it like that. Why do I have to add in the words? The pasuk really did, and not the first. That's a drash question. And therefore, in pursuit of drash, if you wish to know how it could be that they will specifically believe the second one, the answer is, well, it's a drash answer, because you'll say, I spoke Lashon Hara about you. So that's why Rashi's responding to that part of the pasuk. But the pshat never goes away, and the pshat is cumulative. And therefore, says the Be'er Yitzchak wonderfully, when you come to the third pasuk, and the pasuk says if they don't believe the the first two. So then you should do the following. Rashi doesn't say, so what does the following have that the other two didn't have? Because the Pasuk never says they'll believe the third one. It just says do the third one, and therefore you revert back to Pshat, that it's cumulative, and therefore three is better than two, as surely as two is better than one, and Rashi leaves it there. So it's such an elegant, but again, thorough, to understand where Rashi's coming from, you'll understand why he spoke, when he spoke, what he's doing, and why he then stopped talking that way as we move from two to three. So the Bar Yitzchak, as I think as we can already see, is not easy reading, but certainly very profound reading and understanding Rashi, methodology of Rashi. The only question that remains for us is to understand why it is that Moshe was, in a sense, punished almost for saying, they won't believe me. He says, Ve'ele Aminuli. And then he got Saras. Except, was it wrong for him to say that? Wasn't it also true, by the way, that the Jewish people, from a certain point of view, did not believe him? Not fully. And isn't it appropriate to take precautions? And moreover, it almost seems like HaKadosh Baruch is confirming the fact that they won't believe him. Because if Moshe said, they won't believe me, but that was a mistake because they really would, then the answer from HaKadosh Baruch shouldn't have been three signs. It should have been, yes, they will. But apparently, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, in a sense, confirming at least the possibility that they won't. You've got to be prepared. So he didn't dismiss it. So it's an interesting situation, because Moshe raises a fear, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu seems to confirm it, and then Moshe is punished for talking about it. How can it be? Except the biur is, and this is, again, we're talking about Moshe Rabbeinu, light years away from us, but it's a lesson that we can certainly draw for our own experience. Moshe was not punished for raising this fear. He was punished for stating it as a certainty. Because in the beginning of Perek Dalet, Vayan Moshe Vayomer, Vehein lo yaminu li. Hein, not heim. And this is not a feminine verb. Hein means indeed. Hein. And therefore, Vehein Moshe says, there's no way they'll believe me. They will definitely not believe me. Ah, that's already different. To raise the possibility, pen lo yaminu li, maybe that's a valid concern. Not only is it a valid concern, HaKadosh Baruch Hu concurs with it and gave him signs, and he still gave him signs. To say pen lo yaminu li is one thing, but to say lehein lo yaminu li, that's already something else. And it's very interesting that we see that the very same thing can be spoken about. But sometimes even when you need to speak about something, it's the way that you say it. It makes a difference. And this is something that would rebound for Moshe, because there is a famous medrash which says that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe that he was not going to go into Eretz Canaan, he did so with the word hein, right? Vayom Hashem Moshe hein karvu yamecha lamos. Indeed, your days have come near to part from the world. And Moshe was upset by that. Hein. Even if he's told such news, but why told with a hein? He says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I use the word hein to praise you. And you give me this news with the word hein. So Hashem says, yes, because your first hein was behein lo yaminu li. And retief word, because it really has that emphasis and that finality and that absolute character. And what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying to Moshe is, suspicions and concerns should be raised, but never say never, not about Bnei Yisrael. And the truth is, from that point on, Moshe never does. So this is really just the beginning of Geula, and we'll leave it over there for this evening. Just mention again, we'll pick up again, Mitz Hashem, in 2 weeks' time, the Monday before Parshas Bo.